Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, shares with us his views on the current state of relations with the Catholic Church ahead of his meeting on Thursday with Pope Benedict XVI. We take a look back to the huge changes that have taken place in the ecumenical world since the Second Vatican Council. But first, a papal appeal for reconciliation in Lebanon following the murder of a prominent politician. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict on Wednesday made an urgent appeal for a return to reconciliation and national unity in Lebanon following the assassination of the country's Minister for Industry. 34-year-old Pierre Gemayel, a Christian Maronite from a well-known political family, was gunned down on Tuesday while driving through the capital, Beirut. Speaking at his general audience in St. Peter's Square, the Pope condemned what he called the brutal attack and assured both the bereaved family and the beloved Lebanese people of his prayers. My colleague Catherine Smybert has more details.
L'assassinio dell'onorevole Pierre Gemayel.
Speaking to the crowd of over 20,000 gathered in St. Peter's Square for the audience, the Pope described Tuesday's assassination as a brutal attack and assured the victim's family and his beloved Lebanese people of his spiritual closeness at this time. The Pope called on all Lebanese to work for peace and reconciliation, saying that in the face of the dark forces that try to destroy the country, the people of Lebanon should not be overwhelmed by hatred, but use the experience to strengthen national unity, justice and reconciliation, as well as working together to build a future of peace. The Holy Father concluded his appeal by urging countries that care about the fate of that region to contribute to a global and negotiated solution to what he called the injustices that have afflicted the Middle East. In the main body of his audience catechesis, the Pope continued his reflections on the Apostle Paul, turning to his teachings on the Church.
St. Paul's encounter with the risen Lord on their way to Damascus led him to understand that in persecuting the Church, he was persecuting Christ himself.
Paul said the Pope was thus converted both to Christ and the Church.
Paul founded several churches during his missionary journeys, and he demonstrated through his letters and visits a constant and lively concern for all the churches.
Quoting from both St. Paul's letters to the Ephesians and Corinthians, Pope Benedict notes that for Paul, the Church is truly the body of Christ, an extension, as it were, of the risen Lord's presence in the world, enlivened, structured and built up by the gifts of the Holy Spirit.
The Pauline image of the Church as a bride of Christ likewise stresses the relationship of fidelity and love, uniting the Lord and all the members of his body. Through the prayers of St. Paul, may we enter even more deeply into his mystery of communion in order to testify more effectively to Christ's presence in our world.
I'm Catherine Smybert.
Thank you.
40 years on from the Second Vatican Council and the establishment of an Anglican centre here in Rome, the Archbishop of Canterbury and head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion, Dr. Rowan Williams, is in Rome this week for meetings with Pope Benedict and other top Vatican officials. As well as a papal audience on Thursday morning, the Anglican leader is addressing the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, holding a conference at St. Anselm's, meeting with the St. Egidio lay community, and taking part in joint liturgical celebrations with English Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor in the Basilica of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. During a break in his busy schedule, I sat down with Dr. Williams to discuss the current state of Anglican-Catholic relations. Archbishop Rowan Williams, you're here marking the 40th anniversary of that first official visit of an Archbishop of Canterbury to Rome back in 1966. Now, while there's no doubting the incredible progress that's been made in Anglican-Catholic relations since then, many people see the Anglican-Catholic dialogue now in a phase of crisis. How would you characterise the current state of relations?
I wouldn't at all characterise it as crisis. I'd characterise it, as Cardinal Murphy O'Connor has sometimes put it, as having reached something of a plateau. But I'm coming now from spending a morning discussing the future of our dialogue, and we've agreed with the greatest of clarity that there's no interruption of the process of dialogue and there's no lessening of the long-term hope. So, no, I don't think crisis. We have challenges, but I think we're going forward with a great deal of enthusiasm with the dialogue.
And yet many people see the enthusiasm that was there in the wake of the Second Vatican Council as somehow missing from the relationship. How can we perhaps recapture that positive spirit?
I think perhaps in the wake of the Council, the first round of expectations might have been a bit too high, you know, visible unity within our lifetime, which was probably never going to happen. I think the enthusiasm we need to recapture is in two areas. One is what I think the Pontifical Council would now call fundamental ecumenism. That is, recovering our shared identity in the face of a secular cultural environment, so that we know what, as the receivers of a revelation, we have to share with our society. And the second area is in understanding more deeply what we can do practically in response to the needs of the world, how we can pool our resources in meeting the immense crises of humanity in our day. Now, there's plenty there for enthusiasm.
And yet, if we look at the obstacles in this dialogue, one of them is the consideration within the Church of England of ordaining women bishops. Cardinal Casper, earlier this year, said a decision of this kind would lead to a practically insurmountable obstacle in the search for full unity as we've understood it so far.
We've heard that and taken it very seriously, I think. At the same time, we're pursuing in the Church of England a long-term process of theological reflection on this. Part of that process is informed by our commitment to the theology of ordained ministry that has been spelled out in the archic documents. And I think it's going to be extremely important as we go forward to make sure that that remains a central part of the Anglican consideration of this subject, so that whatever decision is made, and I think Cardinal Casper would accept the point, whatever decision is made, we still have a language in which to discuss it, which is based on the agreement we've already shared.
The other obstacle, as perceived from the outside, which is throwing the communion, the Anglican communion itself, into something of a crisis, is this question of homosexuality and the way authority should be exercised within the different provinces. Are you personally optimistic that these particular set of obstacles can be overcome without the communion breaking up, which of course would add an extra difficulty for the Roman Catholic dialogue?
I think there's a huge amount of willingness within the communion to work together. Naturally, we hear a great deal from those who want to split off either on the left or the right. We hear a great deal from those who have a very strong agenda for revising the traditional teaching. We hear a great deal from those who don't even want it discussed at all. But in the middle, I think there's a huge amount of remaining goodwill which is committed to the processes that we're already involved in taking forward the health and the vigour of the communion. Now, this will mean, I think, that we have to look quite hard at how our institutions of authority and unity work. And I think there's a general agreement that we've got a lot more labour to do on these things, that at present we haven't quite got the structures that best serve us, but we already have some processes moving forward to try and remedy that.
This issue of unity of authority is, of course, one with which both the Catholic and the Anglican churches are struggling, if you like. What kind of structures of authority do you feel would best serve the church today?
I suppose that because of my commitment as an Anglican, because of my long-standing relations with the Eastern Orthodox churches, I'm more committed to a conciliar model of authority than to a single centralised figure, like the figure of the Pope. And I hope that if we can, in the Anglican Communion, devise a structure of solemn covenant between ourselves on a firm doctrinal basis, there's something to which we can all be held responsible in the life of the Communion. Now, already that's true, of course. We already do share the creeds and the common deposit of faith. But we perhaps need to spell that out in new ways as local churches become more independent and more distinct. So I don't want to see us moving towards any kind of uncritical centralization. I do want to see us moving towards a better sense of mutual accountability. And within all that, of course, for us as Anglicans, the question that the archic process has raised about what kind of primacy or what kind of Petrine ministry is desirable in the long run for the health of the church, that's a real issue for us, which I know that we'll want to go on considering.
You mentioned the archic process, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commissions. There's talk of an archic three coming
indeed,
out of this
indeed.
Meeting here in Rome. Can you say anything about that?
Well, at the moment, I can say that I'm extremely optimistic about this. We have already begun to discuss the processes by which we might set this up, begun to consider the personnel who might be involved and some of the subject matter. So I feel we're quite well ahead in this discussion.
You've been talking here in Rome about Saint Benedict and his rule as a kind of guide or blueprint for peaceful coexistence in contemporary multicultural Europe. Can you perhaps share some of your ideas here?
The ideas I was trying to elaborate in speaking about St. Benedict centered on three main points. One is that the Benedictine rule assumes that a healthy cultural and individual life is one in which there is time for labor, productive work, for self-knowledge, and for praise. And that any culture which puts so much emphasis on the life of production and acquisition that there's no time for study and self-knowledge and no time for the praise of God is a culture that falls below the human level. The second area that I wanted to look at was the area of obedience and the very subtle way in which the rule of St. Benedict describes how the abbot, the senior authority figure in the monastery, has to be himself a model of obedience to God and a kind of obedience to the community, listening to the needs of the community and responding. So we have to think of how authority is exercised in society and in Europe generally, an authority that truly listens and responds to real need but is also open to God. And thirdly, the rule of St. Benedict assumes that there are no passengers in the Benedictine community. Everyone has the dignity of making a contribution by their work, by their skill, just by their presence and their experience. And that, I think, has a lot to say to societies coping with minorities, with migrants, and trying to find a way in which all voices can be heard and harmonized in society. So I think the rule is an extremely contemporary document for Europe and for each of us.
You're talking, of course, about St. Benedict, about a shared monastic tradition.
Yes.
Do you see this as one of the keys, perhaps, to the future of our Anglican-Catholic dialogue?
I think it's already one of the great steps forward that's been made in the last few years, that the experience of the religious life is being shared across our communions, that for longer and shorter periods, members of Anglican and Roman Catholic communities exchange life in other houses. And I think there is a very strong sense of the common heritage that's brought to bear here.
You're talking about contemporary European issues and particularly the current crisis, the tensions between the Islamic world and Europe or the West. Are you hopeful that the church can play a strong role here in trying to ease these tensions?
I'm extremely confident, actually, of the church's role here. The church, after all, is not a Western cultural phenomenon. The church is a universal phenomenon. The church is, as of course we might very well say in Rome, a Catholic phenomenon. It's something for all kinds of human beings in every cultural context. It's very important, then, to remember that the church has lived in and alongside Islamic societies in many contexts in the past, as it does today, and that the church is always at some distance away from being completely committed to any one cultural or political form. So it's certainly not a tool of Western civilization. It shares with Islam a commitment to the spiritual destiny of human beings. It's able to talk at that level. It also has some critical questions to put to Islam, which can only be put on the basis of trust and understanding. The church, again, is in a good position today to build up such trust and understanding so that such questions can be properly put and properly heard.
You're also holding a special celebration here in Rome to commemorate seven Anglican brothers who were murdered during the civil conflict in Melanesia.
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this history?
One of the greatest phenomena of Anglican missionary life in the last 150 years has really been the church in Melanesia, a church which from the very beginning concentrated on building up local ministry, local priests, and which produced, amazingly, its own local religious order, the Melanesian Brothers. Now, these brothers are known and trusted throughout the islands, not only in Melanesia, but also in Papua New Guinea and in Polynesia, and a little bit in New Zealand as well. During the civil conflicts of 3 years ago in the Solomon Islands, the brothers played a crucial role in mediating between factions at huge risk to themselves. Seven of the brothers were kidnapped by one of the factions and killed in cold blood. And the shock of that experience resonated throughout the islands and was actually a major factor in prompting people to work harder for peace. The thought that, you know, if such trusted and loved people were to be the victims of this kind of violence, then there must be an end to it. I had the great privilege 2 years ago of consecrating a memorial to these martyrs in the Solomon Islands. I've had the great privilege of being alongside the Melanesian brothers in some of their work, and I'm a companion brother myself of the community. So that particular celebration will have an extra meaning for me.
It's a celebration with the Rome lay community of St. Egidio, isn't it, with whom you've been very involved in the past as well?
That's right, and St. Egidio has come to mean a great deal to me in the last few years. Their witness in peacemaking throughout the world, their witness here in Rome, in basic provision for the poor, and in creating a space for real prayer and reflection, especially for young people. It's a real example, I think. It's an example of how some of the most traditional forms of Christian community and Christian worship can come alive in response to the crises and challenges of our day. I think they're a wonderful gift to the church and to the world.
I suppose if you're talking about the current crisis, the secular society that we face in our Western countries, these spiritual concerns that we're talking about are of very little interest to the vast majority of young people in secular Britain today. How can the church really reach these people who know nothing of the church?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure that they're of little interest. People may not know very much about them because these are not stories that make the headlines all the time. And yet, frequently, it's the sheer integrity and the depth of gift and commitment that these stories represent. It's these things which speak most directly to young people. It's not easy religious entertainment that draws people in, trying to make the church part of an entertainment industry. It's not browbeating people into believing a set of propositions and keeping a set of rules. Let all that follow. First of all, it's people being really enthused and captured by the sense that here are lives that are worth living, so much worth living, they're even worth giving up for the sake of God. That's always how martyrdom works as part of our mission.
And my thanks there to Dr. Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury and head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. As well as his important meetings with Pope Benedict and other Vatican officials, Archbishop Williams is also presiding over a number of special celebrations marking the 40th anniversary of the founding of the Anglican Centre here in Rome, a direct result of the change in ecumenical relations which emerged from the Second Vatican Council. Marist Father Fred Bliss coordinates the ecumenical program at the Angelicum University here in Rome. He's also the author of a new book called Anglicans in Rome, which documents the extraordinary changes that have taken place in Anglican-Catholic relations over the past 40 years.
Since this is the 40th anniversary of establishing the Anglican Centre in Rome, at about the time of Vatican II, there was a desire to record in some way a little history of the 40 years, tracing relationships over the centuries between Anglicans and Catholics, especially in England, and then the overtures made by prominent Anglican people in England to Rome because they found that there was not very much a climate in Britain for dialogue to take place. And so quite a few of the leading churchmen made overtures, and the person that they came into contact with principally here was Cardinal Montini, Archbishop at one stage, then Cardinal. And so they used to come and visit him when he was working in the Vatican offices. And then when he moved to Milan as the Archbishop there, he invited five or six of them, to visit him so that he could learn about Anglicans from Anglicans. And thereafter, when the centre was actually established in Rome, he made it very clear to all the directors that they always had access to him whenever they wanted to discuss anything about Anglican-Catholic relationships.
You're talking the years before the council, aren't you? The 1950s, really.
Yes.
What do you think was the background to this interest that, well, the future Pope Paul VI had in the Anglican world?
He had an interest first from he made a visit to Britain, and he was very, very impressed by the cathedrals and the cathedral choirs. And he developed an interest in English church or Anglican church music. He also had an abiding interest in Bede and the history of Bede, and so he actually asked some Anglicans would they find for him a good biography of Bede. And so it was this developing interest that he had from very early years that continued into his papacy and became a great backdrop. And as one or two of the experts have said, he is the only pope who has really ever taken time out to study Anglicanism and come to understand them.
This must have been an incredibly valuable thing during the council itself.
Yes. The Pope himself was determined to steer the council in the direction of opening out to wider society and in particular to other Christian churches. He saw and expected that there would be a real possibility of reunion between Catholicism and Anglicanism. And he was working towards that. And so I'm quite convinced that the Unitatis Rei Integratio, the document on ecumenism, owes a tremendous amount to the understanding of Paul VI and to his relationship with Anglicans. It figured a great deal in his thinking, how he could build relationships. And that's where, for example, when he offered his ring to the Archbishop on his visit, it was something he had learnt about from Cardinal Mercier years before, who had given his ring on his deathbed to the prominent Anglican Lord Halifax. And Montini's remark was to say, that was a very profound thing to do, a sublime act. And so he saw that these symbolic gestures were significant in terms of building relationships.
I suppose he might be quite disappointed today, do you think, to see that his dreams of unity, reunification between the two churches simply haven't come about?
Yes, he would be. But even during the latter years of his pontificate, when there was the possibility of women priests being ordained in the Anglican communion, he reacted quite vigorously, and it's reported in the book there, the occasions when he was told about this, and he could see this, if it occurred, would be an impediment to the reunion that he so desired between the two churches.
What perhaps gives you most hope at the moment, despite these new difficulties that we see?
We have arrived at a huge amount of agreement on a great variety of issues. And so what we've got to do presently is to consolidate the relationship in terms of the agreements we've reached over the years. After all, the dialogue began in the 1960s. Archic 2 concluded just last year. We're hoping that there's going to be a move into the future, that there'll be the opening towards an Archic 3. And so that there's always that hope. There's never an ending to the relationship. It's a question of deepening what our baptismal relationship means, of deepening our understanding of the Eucharist, of deepening what our understanding of the Church is. And for both of us, we're still on a journey into understanding those significant areas of ecclesiastical life.
And my thanks there to Marist Father Fred Bliss, coordinator of the ecumenical program at the Angelicum University. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. But we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. In the meantime, don't forget you can always find our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.